Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland. Most of us would rather not contemplate losing our jobs. No doubt even the nuclear scientists at Lawrence Livermore Labs didn't see it coming this week. They probably had something like this going through their big brains.
I think we all have this bulletproof sort of feeling about ourselves that probably won't happen to me. How could they fire me? Look at the difference I make here. And they convince themselves that they're indispensable.
We'll explore how to handle a layoff. And when it comes to putting today's high-priced food on the table...
I buy in bulk where I can. Sometimes it goes bad because I'm single.
Well, we've stopped buying things like soda and stuff like that, so we just buy, like, things we need.
We've got your guide to cooking on the cheap. Those stories and so much more are coming up next on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. The layoff announcements are coming fast and furious these days. 3,000 at Continental Airlines, another 1,500 at United, almost 700 at Spirit Airlines. What's next for all those people? I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 financial services organization offering insight, products, and planning tools to help members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thrivent.com/retirement.
This week, the Labor Department reported that the economy shed 49,000 jobs in May, many of them in manufacturing, retailing, and construction. All of those pink slips generate fear and uncertainty, and the question, what happens now? For some answers, reporter Andrew Phelps turned to one winner in this economic downturn, the layoff coach.
Corporate downsizing can be a scary thing. People imagine a bunch of faceless managers firing workers at random, like at Inatech, the fictional company in the film Office Space.
Right, so there's three more people we can easily lose. And then there's Tom Sinkowski. He's useless. Gone.
Doug Walker says it doesn't have to be so inhumane. It's his mission to meet people at their lowest moment, right after they've lost their job, and help them find a new one.
It's really quite a rush to see somebody that you've seen in their darkest time, and you're toasting their new job that they just landed.
Walker is a layoff coach, or as he puts it, an outplacement consultant for DBM Career Services. It's a 40-year-old company with offices in 45 countries, and business is booming.
DBM gets busiest when the economy is either tanking and a lot of companies are laying off, or when the economy is growing and there's lots of mergers and acquisitions going on.
After a company lays people off, Walker is brought in to guide the newly unemployed through the pitfalls of a job search, the self-loathing, the lack of motivation. Many people he meets are devastated, even if they saw the writing on the wall.
I think we all have this bulletproof sort of feeling about ourselves that probably won't happen to me. How could they fire me? Look at the difference I make here. And they convince themselves that they're indispensable.
That's exactly how Steve Young of San Diego felt. He was one of Walker's clients. After 30 years in the Navy, Young worked another 7 years for a private contractor. He never thought about his job hunting skills because he was always employed. And then one day, a contract fell through.
I won't say devastated, but I was put back because of being let go. And it was deflating.
Fast forward to today, he's a program manager for the
Navy Region Southwest Integrated Solid Waste Program.
That's right. Young oversees trash collection for the Navy. Talk about job security.
I love it. I love it. I mean, I'm in a new industry. I'm in a new career path that I've not been in before.
Young's job is to keep industrial waste out of the landfill. As a self-described tree hugger, he's like a professional environmentalist for the U.S. government. But getting here was a journey.
After a while, after even a week or two, people get concerned that they're going to have to settle for something they don't really want. What they helped me was to keep my passion strong and go out there and knock on doors, make phone calls, submit resumes, and sure enough, it paid off.
For this job, Young had to compete with civilians, making it even harder to stand out. He learned a skill called the elevator pitch, a 2-minute presentation that could win over any hiring manager. He learned about little things like sending handwritten thank you notes after an interview. And he learned to always be on the lookout for his next job, even if he loves his current one.
The time to be networking is while you're working.
Doug Walker again from DBM.
Because you want your network in place when the job goes out from under you.
Walker himself seems to have plenty of job security, so I asked him, are you prepared to get laid off tomorrow?
Yeah, absolutely. At first, are you trying to give me a message? Did anybody send you here?
I know nothing, I promise. Walker does say the average American job lasts 3 years, and he hit that milestone 5 years ago. He says he could be on borrowed time. In San Diego, I'm Andrew Phelps for Marketplace Money.
We mentioned all those airlines that are pointing workers to the exits. The effort to stop the red ink also includes price hikes for passengers. The website bestfares.com found that airfares on some nonstop routes cost 365% more than at this time last year. That doesn't even count all the new fees they're tacking on. Wall Street Journal travel columnist Scott McCartney joins us. And Scott, we've heard about the baggage fees. What else can customers expect?
It pretty much runs the gamut, particularly at American now. Anything that they could raise or charge you for, they're doing it. The fee to put an unaccompanied minor on an airplane, something people do in the summer when they send kids off to summer camp, that's gone from $75 up to $100. The fee to take a pet in the cabin with you, $100 up from $80. If you want to redeem your frequent flyer miles for a quote-unquote free ticket, there's now a $5 fee for online booking. Some of the fees that are going to hit people more than they realize are the fee for changing a ticket has gone up to $150 at American and United from $100. You can, you know, have a $300 ticket, and by the time you're done, you're going to run into fees that may exceed the price of the ticket.
Is it possible to figure out not only what your fare is going to be, but what all these various fees are going to be? I mean, you don't get that, say, from Expedia, do you?
No, you don't. You really have to get into the fine print of the airline fee structure and contract of carriage. It's really not simple at all to do. Some of the booking fees you'll get up front if you're on the phone with an agent or you're booking online and there's a fee associated with that. But you don't know what kind of baggage fees you're going to face unless you weigh your baggage, count your baggage, make sure it's not oversized. And even some of the baggage rules, there are a host of rules at airlines for unusual items, scuba gear, surfboards. There's a lot of chuckling that went on when Frontier Airlines out in Denver recently raised the fee for transporting antlers. Hunters bring their antlers.
Are we simply in an era where you should expect nothing but getting from point A to point B?
You know, it's a fascinating question. What do you get when you buy an airline ticket? You get transportation. We're going to get you from point A to point B, maybe not on time, maybe not with your baggage, but that's what you get with the ticket. Basically, it's a la carte. It's not all that dissimilar from going to a movie theater. What you get with your $10 for your movie ticket is a seat in the movie theater if you want popcorn or soda or anything else. It's extra, and that's where airlines are headed.
How much of this is a psychological game with passengers? Instead of charging me an extra $25 for my pet, why not just raise the airfare?
There is a psychological aspect to it in terms of buying tickets. Customers are very price sensitive when you look at what the ticket price is online, a lot less sensitive to the fees and things that may come later. The problem that airlines face right now is that fuel costs have gone up 66% so far this year.
Oof.
They've only been able to raise fares through April 6% domestically. If they pushed fares up to the level that they would have to cover the rise in fuel costs, people would stop buying tickets. But the other thing that's going on, I think, is that airlines have been surprised at how customers have adapted to fees. It started when they took away food. Lo and behold, you know, people adjusted to that. And now let's just do what we can and keep fares as low as we can so we get people still coming out to the airport.
Scott McCartney writes the middle seat column for the Wall Street Journal. And as always, we hope and pray that he doesn't spend too much time there. Do you?
I do every now and then, yes. Builds character.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Good to be with you.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 financial services organization offering insight, products, and planning tools to help members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thrivent.com/retirement. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
Our economics editor, Chris Farrell, is here with the audio op-ed we call The Straight Story. And Chris, can we say meltdown?
Or maybe a melt-up when it comes to oil prices.
Yeah. You know, we already mentioned the unemployment statistics earlier in the show, and we topped that this week with a one-day $11 spike in oil prices, and you get a 400-point plunge on the Dow. What's most to blame here?
Oh, I think it really is the combination of the two factors, but I would put the primary emphasis on the unemployment number.
Really?
And here's why. You go from 5% to 5.5%. And take a look at what's happening to consumers right now. What does this spike in oil prices mean, Tess, in the next couple of weeks when you're driving your car and you go into the gas station to fill it up?
Higher gas prices, yeah.
It means higher gas prices, and it does. And then think about what's happening to the consumer. Consumers now going to be more fearful about the job market. And this is a consumer that's already being hit with negative wage growth after you adjust for inflation, right?
Mm-hmm.
Falling home prices, and it's getting more expensive to borrow, at least if you're in the private market and you're trying to take out a mortgage. I don't know if you've been watching mortgage rates lately, but they're going up.
You know, I want to ask about this report that came out from Morgan Stanley on Friday morning, which talked about that they're expecting oil to hit $150 a barrel, probably by July 4th. Now, frankly, I feel like I've been hearing $150 a barrel, $200 a barrel for weeks, if not months. Why does the market react so severely to something like that?
Well, there are a number of computer programs out there which the hedge funds, and hedge funds I'm really using as a category, a speculative trader, the computer programs are saying prices are going to go up. And then there's a lot of discussion about turmoil, increased turmoil in the Middle East. So this forecast, which you're absolutely right, I believe several weeks ago, T. Boone Pickens, you know, the legendary oil man, had made a similar forecast. The market didn't really respond to that. Why did it respond on Friday? Well, I think it had to do is prices were already going up. We've had the biggest two-day increase in oil trading since the history of the founding of the New York Mercantile Exchange. So it was just throwing gasoline on the fire.
Oh, great.
Hey, how'd you like that?
Well done, my friend. So very quickly, you know, a few weeks ago we had you on to talk about speculators in the market, and you said, they provide a service for all of us. You still standing by that?
Look, there are days when it's a little bit scary and the speculation can be really bad and it can do damage. I like speculators because they help us seek out higher prices. They help bring about some change. But this movement that we've seen is disturbing. Is it lasting? $150 a barrel oil? I don't know. But if it were me, and I am like a lot of like you and everyone else watching this market, I'd be careful.
All right. The Straight Story from our economics editor, Chris Farrell. Hey, thanks so much for helping us out.
Hey, thanks a lot.
Grocery shoppers rejoice. There's one place where it is great to be nickel and dimed.
Kind of started with discovering the 99-cent store in my neighborhood. They have junk, but they also have some great things.
It's all coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland.
In Haiti, deadly riots over food prices.
Costco is now limiting purchases of rice and
stuff. Winter wheat in Kansas City's up 25 cents. Corn prices.
This week, the United Nations held a global food summit to talk about the soaring price of the stuff we eat. It's really bad in other parts of the world. But even here in the U.S., food bills jumped 7% in April alone. Compare that to a 5% hike for all of 2007. As part of our series Food Fight, looking at the world food crisis, we asked Brendan Noonan to find out how Americans are adapting.
To find out how rising food prices affect people, I asked them.
I buy in bulk where I can. Sometimes it goes bad because I'm single.
Well, we've stopped buying things like soda and stuff like that, so we just buy like things we need.
Milk used to be a staple, now we just have to decide whether we really want it or not.
But apparently vodka is still a staple in your family?
Of course. For a party, you can't just have milk.
Yes. But what about mixing up a White Russian? All the folks I talked to were outside my local Costco, which at 5 o'clock on a Wednesday was a madhouse. And that's the scene at wholesale clubs around the country. Costco, BJ's, and Sam's Club are doing swift business these days as more and more people respond to rising food prices by buying in bulk. And why are they buying in bulk?
Well, the first thing that's happening is that people aren't eating out as much.
Marion Nessel is a, well, let her tell you.
As a nutritionist, that's something that seems really good to me. Food at home is usually healthier. It doesn't have as many calories. And there are many, many reasons for cooking at home.
One of the main reasons cooking at home is healthier is because you don't eat as much, and the food generally doesn't have as much fat, salt, and sugar. Nessel, who teaches all about nutrition and public health at New York University, says the ground rules for eating healthy are simple.
All you have to do is eat less, move more, eat plenty of fruits, vegetables, and whole grains, and don't eat too much junk food. That's really all there is to it.
Well, that's not all there is to it. For example, a bag of potatoes is cheaper and will provide more meals than, say, a can of potato chips. But turning potatoes into a meal takes some doing.
You have to be sophisticated in order to be able to do that. First of all, you have to have cooking facilities. You have to have pots. You have to have ingredients. You have to have spices. You have to have all of these things that where the costs add up. And you have to know how to prepare foods. Most of all, you have to have the time to do it.
And that's why people on tight budgets often turn to junk food, where they can get cheap calories fast. But that needn't be. Meet Billy Vasquez, a.k.a. the 99-cent chef.
Nice to meet you. Welcome to the Village Green and to the 99-cent chef's kitchen.
Vasquez lives here in L.A., where he runs a cooking blog that features meals made entirely out of ingredients he finds at his local 99-cent store. He got the idea when he was between jobs.
Kind of started with discovering the 99-cent store in my neighborhood. They have junk, but they also have some great things. And when you find something great, you want to go back and check it out.
So that's what we did. As we drove to the 99-cent store to shop for dinner, I expected to find generic laundry detergents and old calendars. And when I arrived, I found generic laundry detergent and old calendars. But there was also food. A lot of it.
Okay, I'm going to pick up some spinach. 6 ounces for 99 cents. This is usually like about $2.50 at least at a regular store.
Do you have to worry about the dates?
Hey, it's still green. That's all I care about.
But can it turn green?
Here is crab, spelled with a K, green beans, pound of pork sausage.
Looks like it kind of is open there on the side.
You got to watch out for that kind of thing. Let's see, cheese ravioli, about 2 pounds of green grapes, tomato, cucumber, fresh produce, fresh butter, liverwurst, pumpkin seeds, chopped garlic, extra virgin olive oil, organic whole peeled tomato, caramel chili with beans, chunk light tuna, candy hot dogs with candy mustard on it.
And all three.
When we got back to his kitchen, the chef worked his magic on our 99-cent purchases, and within 15 minutes, we were sitting down to a meal of breaded pork chops with sautéed spinach and mushrooms on the side. Oh, and two 99-cent Pabst Blue Ribbons.
Cheers. Bon appetit.
If you include those, the meal for two cost about $5.
Excellent. Juicy.
Tender.
When we were sated, I asked the chef why he blogged about 99-cent cuisine.
Because when you watch these cooking shows, you know, everything has to be the best ingredients, the finest wine, the best, you know, whatever. I'm like going, this isn't the real world. you know, the real world is when I come home, you know, at 8 at night, there's no time to create this beautiful dinner of appetizer and entree and dessert. So what I like to work with is a very simple meal. And 99-cent Lifestyle kind of provides that.
And since food prices will rise for the foreseeable future, the 99-cent Lifestyle is something we can all embrace. I'm Brendan Noonan for Marketplace Money.
I'm thinking the 99-cent chef should negotiate a deal with 30-minute Rachel Ray. Speaking of negotiation, anybody out there as bad at it as I am? If so, especially from my sisters out there, you might want to read a new book from Carnegie Mellon econ professor Linda Babcock. It's called Ask For It: How Women Can Use the Power of Negotiation to Get What They Really Want. Welcome.
It's nice to be here.
You say right off the bat in your book that everything is negotiable. Is that really true if you're fighting to get a job?
Absolutely. You know, the recruiter or the person hiring you expects you to negotiate. And so they're not going to offer you the absolute most they're willing to pay. They're going to leave a little wiggle room in there because they do expect people to negotiate.
How do you know what's fair in terms of what you are asking of them?
You can get online, consult different salary surveys, and find out what your market value is. It's really important to go into a negotiation knowing what that is. And if you don't, you really won't know what it's right to be asking for. And so that doing that homework really gives you that confidence that what you're asking for is what you're worth.
But there are all kinds of other options within a negotiation, aren't there? I mean, there's vacation, other family leave, that sort of thing. Are those all part of the negotiation package?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And it's not just first time a job negotiation, but it's all the little negotiations that you do while you're working someplace.
But what about when we're talking about money? I mean, that's really what we're talking about here. And anytime, at least I've talked about money, it is absolutely terrifying. And I'm sure that comes through and makes me a bad negotiator.
Well, I'm sure it does come through. And you know what really might help you is to think about role-playing the negotiation ahead of time. So if you're going to go into your boss and ask for more money, sit down with a friend who knows your boss and have that friend play the other side and do the negotiation several times so that you get really comfortable, you know, so that you can really feel calm and confident going into that negotiation, knowing that whatever happens, you're going to be ready for.
Are these skills that, in general, men seem to have more than we women do?
Well, it's definitely right, because little boys in our society are really taught to be aggressive and to go after what they want. And little girls in our society, even today, are still really taught to be grateful for what they have, and so don't have as much experience as men going into the workplace and then negotiating for what they want.
How much can it cost us, or does it cost us, over the long haul if we are bad negotiators to begin with?
Our estimates show that if you don't negotiate your first job out of school, you lose anywhere between $750,000 and $1.5 million over the course of your career.
Yikes.
Just for not negotiating that one time. That's a lot of money.
What advice do you have for women whose prior negotiations have utterly failed?
Well, but sometimes that's good. Like, think about if you always went into a negotiation and the other person always said yes right away. What would that be telling you?
That you're not asking for enough.
Exactly. So every once in a while, you really should fail at a negotiation, just because that is an indication to you that you're pushing the boundaries a little bit, that you're not selling yourself short. So occasionally you should see negotiations fail.
Linda Babcock is the author of Ask For It: How Women Can Use the Power of Negotiation to Get What They Really Want. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 financial services organization offering insight, products, and planning tools to help members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thrivent.com/retirement. And by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about the economy at Gather.com. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation, online at kauffman.org.
It's time for Getting Personal, and that's when we answer your money questions. With me once again is our economics editor, Chris Farrell. Hello again, Chris.
It's good to be back with you.
All right. Our first caller is Angela, and she's in Washington, D.C. Hi, Angela.
Hi, Tess.
I understand you're a new homeowner.
I am.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Well, tell us what your question is for Chris today.
I bought the house for $590,000, but the house actually appraised at $650,000. So I put down $60,000, and then I have another $60,000 in equity. if you look at the appraisal versus what I paid for it.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So my question has to do with the private mortgage insurance, PMI. But I know that PMI is supposed to go away when you hit 20% equity.
Right.
So my question is, with the $60,000 I put down, plus the $60,000 that I have in equity on the house, when does that PMI go away?
Chris, it sounds like she should be able to go without PMI. Why do you think she has to pay it?
It all has to do with home appreciation. You don't need PMI if you put the 20% down, so that would be $120,000. Or by paying off the loan and you pay down the loan, you hit that $120,000 mark, no PMI. The rules get squishy when it comes to treating appreciation. What we're going to do is just look at the Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac rules. What they say is that, first of all, any loan must be seasoned. It needs to be at least 2 years old before a cancellation can be based on price appreciation. So if your house appreciates over the next 2 years, then you can apply to your lender and say, hey, look, you know, the price has appreciated. And if the loan is between 2 and 5 years old, the servicer can cancel your private mortgage insurance if a current appraisal, an appraisal done at that time, shows that it has a loan-to-value ratio of 75%. In other words, including appreciation, you have 25% equity in your home.
So basically, the appraisal that she has now that says that her home is worth $650,000, it's just a piece of paper.
It's just a piece of paper. At this point, what's going to matter is what's the appraised value in 2 years.
Can I refinance in 6 months?
If there's no prepayment penalty and you can refinance and put more down, then you can get rid of the private mortgage insurance that way. Absolutely.
But would I have to put down a whole another 10%, or wouldn't some of that equity transfer over?
In general, no one is going to let you refinance based on price appreciation in this market at this point in time. What they're trying to do is get past the quote-unquote foreclosure risk, which is why they want the loan to be seasoned. They want to show that you have a little bit of a history of payments. And so you can refinance, but you're not going to be able to refinance in order to get rid of the PMI, which, by the way, is tax deductible.
Well, that's a little silver lining, I guess.
Thanks for the call, Angela. Good one.
Thanks, you guys. I appreciate your show.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
All right, Chris, our website, as we all know, is marketplace.org. And if you've got a question, just click on the Getting Personal link there. Or you can give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Let's reach into the email bag. And Jerry writes in from Portland, Oregon, my hometown. He wants to know what the difference is between a 457 plan and a 403B plan. And I think we've addressed this in kind of different questions before. This is government work versus nonprofit?
Yes. That's sort of the dividing line in general over who is offering the type of plan. But you can also have many institutions that have both retirement savings plans. You know, to a large extent, they're going to seem the same. I mean, the maximum contribution in 2008 is $15,500. If you're over 50, you know, you can make that additional $5,000 contribution. The money you put in is pre-tax money. Your gains are tax deferred. And then when you pull the money out in retirement, you pay your taxes then. So the key difference is on the distribution side. There are two important differences between a 457 and a 403B. It's easier to take out a loan to borrow against your 403B than it is against the 457. The second thing is, let's say you have a 403B, right, Tess?
I do, just like you.
So let's say I just said, I'm going to take some money out. I'm going to take $10,000 out. I just need this money. It's called a premature withdrawal because I am under 59 and a half. And so we'd pay ordinary income taxes on the money we withdrew plus a 10% penalty. With the 457, you pay ordinary income taxes on the money you withdraw, but there is no 10% penalty.
So is there any benefit to splitting up your retirement funding between a 457 and a 403B? Or does he have to choose?
If your company offers both a 457 and a 403B, you can put $15,500 in the 457 and $15,500 into the 403B. Now, if your company happened to offer a 401k and a 403B, you couldn't. It's a maximum of $15,500. The one exception is if your company offers a 457 and a 403B, you can put more than $15,500 into the retirement plan.
All right. Well, there you go, Jerry. Thanks so much for writing in. Once again, our phone number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or now we are also answering your questions every weekday online at marketplace.org. Just click on the Getting Personal link on our website. And stay tuned for more Getting Personal later in the show. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Pile the kids into the car. The animated movie Kung Fu Panda opens this week. Jack Black stars as Po the Panda, or at least his voice does. On this week's A Day in the Work Life, we feature the vocal stylings of someone a bit more anonymous.
The Turbo Diesel Jetta.
Introducing Aquas Theater from Sharp.
Stofa's lean cuisine. Do something good for yourself.
My name is Laura Teasdale. I'm a voice actor. I make my bread and butter doing voices. When I was little, I was always an imitator. I grew up in the East Coast of Canada, and we have strong accents there. So everyone around me had kind of an accent like that, you know, and they'd say, oh, get out of here, and stuff like that. And I would always imitate and copy. And then, of course, my teacher, who was very British, don't you know, and I would copy her quite a bit. And it was always something that I would get praise for. So as kids do, I just kept on doing it. I lucked into a job on a cartoon called City Mouse, Country Mouse. I played the kid in countries around the world where they would go and solve a crime. So they would call me and say, okay, in 2 weeks you have to be a little Indian girl. And then I would study for a week and learn it and try very hard to do that. And then the next time, oh, in 2 weeks you have to do a little Tibetan boy. And I'm where am I going to learn this? I have to get a coach, and it was really challenging. And that was a really good opportunity, and it's given me a lot of confidence with accents. I guess the hardest things that I've done are when they ask you to do, they're trying to save money, so they ask you to do 20 different voices all at once. So one minute you're, oh, I'm a little boy, and then you're a very old Scottish lady, and your just brain is exploding. That is when you're really stressed out. My financial situation is crazy. Some years I feel like I'm rich, and some years I'm very poor. In my 15 years, the most I've made is about $80,000 Canadian, and the least is about $18,000 or $20,000 Canadian. It's really hard not to be silly in the studio because we are doing crazy things. And we're doing it so earnestly and so seriously, trying to get right the way that a kid says, I pooped my pants. No, sorry, I'll get that again. I pooped my pants. You know, it's so ridiculous that after the fifth take, and plus the oxygen gets pretty thin in these little glassed-in studios, we can't resist. One of the funniest things is when an actor that has a very well-known voice, like Danny Brochu, who I worked with recently, he plays Buster Bunny from Arthur, and to hear him use that voice and say, oh, damn it, you know, or it's so funny to hear him say something dirty or something grown up. It's so fun.
A Day in the Work Life was reported by Judith Ritter. Coming up, what it's like to start a company with your spouse.
Whatever you have to say, you get out. You know, you're not worried about hurting somebody's feelings or walking on eggshells. There's really none of that.
And we get personal with more of your financial questions. You're listening to Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Thank you.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. There's been a lot made about the demise of the mom-and-pop store, but that doesn't mean that couples aren't still starting companies together. As of the last census, they ran about 15% of this country's 22 million small businesses. We wondered what it's like to work with your spouse all day, then go home to your spouse. Ashley Milne-Tite has our story.
Patrick Watson and Michelle Proft's first meeting wasn't auspicious. It was 1999. He was beginning a job as a server at a new Mario Batali restaurant in Manhattan.
Michelle was already there, and I walked through the door one day, and I said, I think I'm supposed to train today. And she said, oh, really? Well, nobody told me. Turned around and walked away.
Things improved rapidly. They married in 2001. Now in their mid-30s, they've run Smith & Vine, their Brooklyn wine store, for 4 years.
You've got whites on one side of the store, reds on the other. And then from there, it kind of goes by country. We start with the old...
2 years ago, they opened a specialty food shop nearby. They recently added a wine bar on the next block. They say each business is like a child, and a pretty demanding one. They both work 80 to 90 hours a week. These days, they have staff, but they still spend plenty of time together. Michelle says it works because their personalities complement each other.
Patrick is very sort of very spontaneous, which is wonderful, and I'm sort of calculated, and so it's a good combination. You know, he pushes me to do things, and then I say, wait a minute, let's step back and sort of look at all the parts and put them together.
For instance, Patrick wanted to swap their popular $10 and under wine table for one selling wines for 12 and under. Michelle resisted, afraid that customers would resent the change. Some lively debate ensued. They're now rolling out a 12 and under table with a section devoted to wines for less than 10 bucks. Patrick says they used to wrangle more often.
For the first couple of years, yeah, we arm wrestled on a number of different things. And, you know, and I think eventually you just kind of have to come to the realization, you know, compromise is best. And you have to realize, too, that you're both going to have really strong, really good ideas.
He says the key is to test both sets of ideas and to keep in mind that what's best for the business should trump everything else, including someone's pet project. Not all couples work together so seamlessly. David Chapin used to own a medical transcription business with his wife. She's now his ex-wife. They ran the business from their home in Las Vegas. That, Chapin says, was part of the problem.
It never really dawned on us that there were things we needed to think about being together 24/7. We just thought it was going to be easy.
It wasn't. They had a new baby to care for just at the time they were starting the business. But Chapin says the baby wasn't the main problem. He says increasingly they just got on each other's nerves. His ex-wife didn't want to talk on tape, but she confirmed that being together all the time drove them nuts and that they argued about the company more and more often. Chapin says they'd need to make a decision on some aspect of the business, and he'd say something like this.
This is what I have experience in, and I want you to trust my judgment on this one.
He says his wife would bristle. You can imagine the kind of back and forth they'd get into.
It sounded like what you would see in an argument in a sitcom, and it wasn't funny.
Chapin says their personal spats often meant business decisions were pushed aside. He says the business stagnated. He says his biggest regret is that the two of them didn't discuss ahead of time how to separate business and personal. But not all couples feel such a line is necessary. Michelle Pravda says she and her husband know each other so well, there's no need for boundaries.
Whatever you have to say, you get out. You know, you're not worried about hurting somebody's feelings or walking on eggshells. There's really none of that.
She and Patrick think this lack of ego is part of why they've been successful. The wine store doubled profits in its first year and is still growing. The food shop grew by 70% from its first to its second year. As for David Chapin, after a few years, he offered to go back to marketing work and let his wife run their business alone. Ultimately, they agreed to separate.
The biggest problem for me now is that when you've had your own business, amplified by the fact that it was a family business, that now you've lost both parts. And that's hard.
He sold his half of the company to his ex-wife for a dollar. She says business is great these days. In Brooklyn, Patrick and Michelle are about to add a fourth child to their list of responsibilities, which they admit may make their juggling act a little more complicated. Their first baby, due at the end of July. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace Money.
If you and yours run a business together, we'd love to hear about it. Go to our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrive and Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 financial services organization offering insight, products, and planning tools to help members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thriveand.com/retirement. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. And by FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant-making and educational funding. Online at finrafoundation.org.
All right, Chris, we are back with Getting Personal, and let's go ahead and reach right into the email bag. Sasha writes in from Playa del Rey, California, beautiful beach town. A few years ago, her parents asked her to co-sign her sister's private student loans. They couldn't do it because they had bad credit.
Okay.
She was still in school at the time, didn't understand the magnitude of what she agreed to do. Now she's worried because her sister isn't very good with money, and her parents' credit has improved. They're willing to take over as co-signers. Can you just switch who's co-signing?
Well, what I would do is call the loan company and say, look, we don't want to get rid of a co-signer. We just want to switch co-signers. And having multiple co-signers is always to the benefit of the company. Think about it this way. One reason why I'm very wary about anybody co-signing is that you're taking on this obligation if the student stops making the payments.
Right.
So it's a real risk here. Now, most of your servicing companies have a way for co-signers to get out after a period of time. So when the sister graduates, and then if it's a Sallie Mae, which is one of the big student loan lenders, mm-hmm. a Sallie Mae private loan, 24 consecutive payments, you know, has showing good credit, everything on time, the co-signer can apply to be dropped. Another service provider I was looking at it was 48 straight payments. What's a little bit different about this one is that she's still in school, mm-hmm. and you want to get rid of one co-signer, but you want to put another two co-signers into the mix. I don't see why the service provider wouldn't do it, but it is their choice. I would apply. I would call them, say, this is what we want to do, and then go through the paperwork. From the service provider's point of view, they can say no, but they're still getting the protection that they want, so I don't see why they wouldn't do it.
All right. There you go, Sasha. Thanks so much for writing in. And if you've got a question, just visit our website. We're at marketplace.org. Click on the Getting Personal link there. Or give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. All right, Chris, our next caller is Kathy, and she joins us from Charlotte, North Carolina. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, thank you guys so much for taking my call.
Oh, it's our pleasure. What is your question for Chris today?
Well, I have a 401k plan with my employer, and 2 years back, I took a loan from my 401k plan on a repayment plan to pay myself back in 5 years at a 9% rate of interest to myself.
Okay.
And I'm sort of wrestling with the idea of whether I should just take the remaining balance as a withdrawal at this point, or to struggle through paying myself back. You know, everything has gone up, and I'm really starting to miss that extra income in my pay. So I guess my question, looking at it from two angles, how much am I going to be hurting myself in the long run if I just take the remaining balance as a withdrawal, and what would the tax implications be for me?
Do you mind if I ask what you borrowed for?
Yes, I borrowed $30,000 because my mother was purchasing a property and I actually gave the money to her.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, Chris, Obviously if she's not going to pay herself back, it is going to affect that compounding benefit that you get over time. Any idea how much she might be losing out on?
That's the real long-term impact, just as you put it, Tess. It's that lack of your money compounding over a long period of time.
Yeah.
And that's going to be the big hit that you take long-term. Short-term, you are also going to be taking a hit, and there's two forms of that it comes. One is the loan is treated as in default, which is a horrible-sounding word, but it doesn't get reported to any of the credit reporting bureaus or anything like that. What the government says is, okay, it's an early distribution. Therefore, you're going on the remaining amount, you're going to pay your ordinary income tax rate on it plus a 10% penalty.
So it's just as if she had withdrawn it for no good reason.
For no good reason. So in other words, let's say there's $20,000 left that you need to repay, all right? You won't have to pay ordinary income taxes on 30 because you paid back 10. So it's on the remaining 20, considered early distribution. So your income goes up for this tax year by $20,000. You're going to pay your ordinary income taxes, plus you'll pay a 10% penalty on top of that.
Chris, you said that it's then considered in default. What does that mean?
It's really an early distribution. If you go through the literature, they always will be using the word default, and that sets off all kinds of alarm bells. And am I going to be, is it going to be reported to the credit reporting agencies? Is it going to affect my credit score? And the answer to all of that is no, it won't.
Since it was used for the purchase of a property, aren't there certain exceptions for when you take that money and invest it in real estate or in something like that?
The exception that you get with real estate is the length of time to pay it back. For the typical 401k loan, you have a maximum of 5 years to pay it back. If you quit your job, by the way, that typically shifts to 60 days to pay it back. However, with purchasing a primary residence, 10 to 15 years is common in terms of a payback schedule. So it's a break on the payback schedule, a little more flexibility, but that's the major benefit.
So what do you think, Kathy? I mean, given that Uncle Sam is going to want to take his chunk of it, do you think you'll still stop your repayments?
No, I'm going to suck it up and keep paying myself back. I know that I'll appreciate it in the long term anyway, I'm sure.
Yeah, you will appreciate it when you do decide to retire.
Yes.
Thank you both so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks for the question.
All right, bye-bye.
Well, unfortunately, those are all the calls we can take on this week's show, but Chris is now answering your personal finance questions online every weekday. Just visit our website. It's marketplace.org and click on the Getting Personal link there. You can also call us at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Chris, thanks for the great advice, as always.
Thanks, Tess.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This was the first week of hurricane season. Forecasters at Colorado State University are predicting 8. Now, we've talked ad nauseum on this program about the importance of insurance. It is literally your lifeline to starting over after a disaster. But it can also help out in smaller calamities. Our friend Liz Pauline Weston has written about some of these odd insurance options in her column for MSN Money. So, Liz, take us through some of this coverage.
Okay. Normally in insurance, you are not covered for things that you do deliberately. In other words, if you go out and break somebody's window, you're going to have to pay for that yourself. Here's the situation. I was talking to Bill Cirola, who's a spokesman for State Farm, and he related the story of his friend who walked into the kitchen and found a snake on the floor that was threatening his wife and his 3-year-old child. So he grabbed the first thing that came to hand, which happened to be an axe. And gave the creature 5 or 6 good whacks, which took a big chunk out of his kitchen floor. And Mr. Cirola said, yep, his insurance covered that.
Now, why is that?
Because you are trying to protect your loved ones. And there's some leeway in there that even if you do take big chunks out of your floor in the process, that you weren't doing it deliberately to hurt the floor.
You mentioned waterbed liability.
I love this one. Doesn't that just conjure up disco balls and whatever? If you have a waterbed and you have renter's insurance or condo insurance, go check it out because you probably have waterbed liability, which means if you break that sucker and it leaks into your neighbor's apartment, you're actually covered for the damage that you do downstairs.
And is that something where you have to get specific coverage to the waterbed, or is that just generally covered by your homeowner's policy?
It's usually covered by renters and condos, or it's often covered, I should say, since every policy is different, you have to go check. But if it's not in your particular policy and you happen to have a waterbed, you can go out and buy it.
And you said for apartments and condos, is this not something that's available to homeowners?
Well, generally not, unless you're stacked on top of somebody else, you know, that you have to worry about the water leaking through.
Well, you can leak through to your nice wood floor.
Well, you're always covered for the damage you do to yourself, you know, in those situations. But the worry was that you could damage a neighbor and not have coverage for that because it's, you know, a liability issue. So unless you have a Mondo waterbed that's going to flood the whole neighborhood, you don't probably need it if you're a single, you know, family homeowner.
You also mentioned that there are a couple of benefits that you might have through your health insurance, and one of them is massage.
Well, it can come in different ways. If you have coverage for chiropractic care, you know, the adjustments, and then if your chiropractor says that you need massage as well, that can be covered. Or if you have a workers' compensation injury where massage can help, that's a way it can be covered as well. So if you're a massage junkie like I am, it might be something to check into if that's an issue that you have.
Let's talk about the sometimes troublemakers in the house, kids and pets. I was very surprised to learn that if your dog bites somebody, you may actually be covered for that damage to the other person.
Yeah, insurers now are getting really picky about which dogs they will cover. But otherwise, you know, if your little chihuahua goes out and chomps on somebody, you probably do have liability coverage for the person's, you know, whatever health care they might need, etc. But if the dog bites again, you probably don't have coverage after that. There's sort of a one bite thing. If you do have coverage, you better make sure that that dog is properly trained or kept away from people it could hurt.
And little Susie is playing a little bit of softball in the backyard, and accidentally the ball goes through the neighbor's window.
Clearly an accident.
She's not liable, I assume, at 6 years old.
Well, you could make her work it off, you know, or confiscate her allowance for a while. But no, your homeowner's insurance typically covers that kind of thing.
Now, for going through a neighbor's window.
Exactly. That's, again, a liability issue. Anytime you do something to someone else, there's a liability issue that you have to pay for the damage there. So as long as it was accidental, as long as she didn't go over with the baseball bat and break the window, then you're covered.
Okay, well, let's end this conversation with the end, which is your tombstone may be insurable or insured.
This is one I never would have thought of. It was pointed out to me by an insurance professional. But yeah, if somebody goes and knocks over a loved one's tombstone or vandalizes it in any way, your homeowner's insurance may cover the restoration. So again, you have to look at your policy. Now, it won't cover a tombstone that's swept away in a flood or blown away by a hurricane or shaken apart by an earthquake. But if somebody deliberately does something to it, you probably have coverage.
I guess that's because it's your home for the afterlife?
Maybe so.
All right. Liz Pulliam Weston is a columnist with MSN Money. Good stuff.
Thanks, Tess.
And here's one way you can help yourself out when it comes to insurance. Do a home inventory. Everything you own from floor to ceiling. We show you how. Just go to our website. It's marketplace.org. And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, planning for the end of your life. Yeah, we're going there.
It's not all about money. The first thing I think you need to look at is, do you have any minor children? Or do you anticipate having minor children?
Wills, trusts, and more in our series about estate planning. Marketplace Money is produced by Nancy Fargali with Stephen Hoffman, Janae Darden, James Richter, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Viglund. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 financial services organization offering insight, products, and planning tools to help members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thrivent.com/retirement.
American Public Media.